This is Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. This is the second day of our two-week series, The Long Haul, looking at the future of New England's fishing industries. Today, we're exploring the role of science in fisheries. The Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act of 1976 is the federal law that mandates and guides fishery management. It calls for regulations to be based on, quote, the best available science. But what is that and who's the judge? This hour, we'll hear about advancements in fishery science, the need to incorporate more social science into the fishery management framework, and about the different roles that academic and government labs play in the advancement of fishery science. Joining me now in our Woods Hole studio is Dr. Bill Karp. He's the director of the Northeast Fisheries Science Center. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, who decides what is best science?
That's a very good question. And, of course, it's always changing. Best science is we are always improving science, and by we I mean the whole community is always improving science. So there's no single point at which you can define best available science. So there's always a degree of ambiguity in that phrase. But what we look for is science that has been peer-reviewed, so that independent scientists have reviewed the science that we have done and that our partners have done, and determined that it meets certain standards so that it is appropriate to be used for providing management advice.
Now, this issue of peer-reviewed science comes up time and again, not just in fisheries, but in a whole host of issues. What is it about this peer review process that makes that the gold standard for science?
It's an independent evaluation of the quality of the integrity of the science that's been done. And so peers are selected who have expertise in the field, but who have not been involved in the work that's been done and that is under review.
Now, peer review sometimes in government publications as opposed to the scientific journals is sometimes a different process, as I understand it. So does most of the science coming out of, say, the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, which is a government laboratory, it's part of the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. Does that science go through the same peer review process to go to a scientific journal, or do government white papers go through a different process?
A lot of the science that our scientists produce is produced in the form of publications in journals. So, of course, that is subject to the journal review process that you just referred to. For stock assessments, which support advice for management decision making, a slightly different process is used, but it's very, very similar. We have what we call benchmark stock assessments, which is where a full and comprehensive review of the status of a particular stock is made. And for a benchmark, we bring in at least three entirely independent experts who sit in a panel and who review every step of the analysis and of the data that support the analysis for the stock assessment. So, in fact, it's a lot more comprehensive than a review of a paper, a manuscript that's being submitted to a journal, because it goes into the details of the data, the analytical details, and it's designed to be an interactive process. And so the reviewers first listen to the scientists, and then there's an intense back and forth discussion before the reviewers reach their conclusions and provide their determination as to whether the assessment itself has met the quality standards.
Now, these fishery stock assessments, particularly the benchmark stock assessments, are some of the most high-profile science, especially coming out of fisheries. They impact all of the management decisions that are made about these given stocks. And in recent years, they've been the subject of some real controversy. Politicians from Massachusetts have even gotten into the fray, calling for more frequent assessments, calling for better assessments. Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley recently actually sued NOAA, saying that the science behind cod management was, quote unquote, flawed science. So do you stand behind these assessments? Is it the best possible science?
I do stand behind the assessment, and I believe it is the best possible science. Again, there are always unanswered questions, and there are always new directions to go and new studies that to be conducted. And so we certainly have unanswered questions regarding the status of all of the stocks, not least of which it itself represented the best available science to support an assessment to characterize the condition of that stock at that time.
So where does this perception that the science is flawed come from?
It's a very good question, and it's one that I'm troubled about. I think, first of all, we're bringing bad news, and bringing bad news makes life difficult for everybody. We understand that as a consequence of our assessments and the scientific advice that's derived from them, decisions are being made which really are affecting the lives of fishermen and communities in the region. And that's a significant concern to all of us. And so I think it places an extra burden on us as a science center that provides most of the science to support decision-making to go the extra mile to help people to understand what it is that we are doing, where there are uncertainties, and why it is that we're seeing what it is that we're seeing.
As you said, you are the bearer of bad news as the scientists having to tell the managers and the fishing community that this is what you're finding with regard to the health or the not-so-healthy stocks that we have in our waters. But how does that then translate into management decisions? You guys aren't the ones actually making those management decisions or that mandate the cuts in catch limits.
No. We're providing the scientific analyses, which includes certain criteria, certain reference points, and certain pieces of information from which the management advice is derived. So we are giving advice through the Council's Scientific and Statistical Committee of what harvest levels should be to meet the mandated criteria, particularly in the case of stocks which are overfished or subject to overfishing, where there are some very restrictive requirements relative to how harvest levels can be set.
Now, there's sometimes a perception that there's a conflict of interest between having both the research, the science branch, and the management branch of fisheries be all within that one umbrella, and enforcement, of course, as well, all under the one umbrella of the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA. Do you see that as a conflict of interest to have both the science and the management in one government agency?
No. First of all, the offices, the science and the management offices are separate. We work very closely together, but they're under different direction. And so the science, the work of the Science Center is independent. And the advice that we give, of course, is used in many different ways, not just the ones that I've described. But I don't see a conflict there, because we're really following the requirements of the Act with regards to the science that we provide to support decision making. But it's an open process, and so the assessments that we do, the evaluations of the assessments that go on through the review process and by the SSC are open to the public. People who have additional information to bring forward, be they academics, be they other government scientists, be they representatives of the industry, that information is all brought forward and is all considered in the process.
So I think the assessments are often viewed as a black box. There's a lot that goes into them, but it's not always clear what that is. So talk a little bit about the diversity of science that you do at the Fisheries Science Center and how that feeds into the assessment and management framework.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because the Science Center has a great deal of breadth and depth in marine science and in the science that is necessary to understand what is going on in the regional marine ecosystems and how change is occurring as a result of changes in climate and other factors. And so we have scientists who are involved in many different aspects of that research. Much of the work is done in collaboration with researchers at other government institutions, at academic institutions, and through with cooperative research that you mentioned. But it's my feeling that it's the breadth and depth of the science that we do which adds considerable integrity to the stock assessment process itself.
What do you mean by that? Expand on that a little.
We have people who are looking at the different processes that are going on in the ecosystem, understanding predator-prey interactions, understanding how those interactions change with respect to environmental change, how the various physiological processes, age and growth, maturity, those kinds of things, how those are all influenced by changes in the ecosystem and by the manner in which the different animals in the ecosystem interact with each other. And it's that kind of depth of understanding that's really necessary to bring into context the stock assessments themselves.
So does that sort of information actually get incorporated into the assessments, or is that, as you say, kind of the context around the assessments?
A little bit of each. We're moving towards a more integrative approach to stock assessment. And some of our assessments are able to directly recognize some of the environmental ecosystem signals that I spoke to. In other cases, we look to our understanding of what's going on, again, to basically place the assessments in context. If the kinds of changes that we're seeing are consistent with the results of an assessment, then that's a part of the story that we need to bring forward.
Let's talk about the attempt to actually improve the assessment science and all the other science that you do. You say you're always pushing and trying to improve science. What is the greatest challenge to actually improving that science?
I would say there are two challenges. One is the pressure of the demands to provide information, which create a real challenge in developing the science and incorporating new ideas because of the expectations for delivering assessments for management advice. The other challenge, but I think it's a challenge that is really one that we're moving forward on, is improving the integrative nature of the work that we do. And again, I think the importance is that we, as with a big W, we as a science center, as a part of a government agency, can't do this alone. We recognize fully that there's a great deal of talent and expertise out there in the academic community. We recognize that we've learned a lot in the past through cooperative research, but that there's many more types of cooperative research studies that we need to be engaged in to learn from the fishermen, to engage the fishermen in the science as well. I'm a firm believer that the fishermen are as much scientists as we are. They're seeing what's going on out there ahead of us. They're seeing it, again, in a different context and different spatial and temporal scales. But the more we can listen to them and tap into their observations, the stronger we can make our overall assessments and perhaps the more credible they're going to be to all of our stakeholders.
Well, certainly there's been this historic tension between fishermen and scientists, fishermen saying that the science doesn't necessarily reflect what they're seeing on the water. So it would seem that this cooperative research could help address that issue, but you're saying it actually could potentially get you better science if you're working with the fishermen. So does that elevate perhaps cooperative research if we're looking at what constitutes best available science? Is cooperative research inherently perhaps a little bit better on that scale than traditional science being carried out just by fishery scientists?
I'm not sure that it's better, but I think it certainly is good and as important. The challenge is how to incorporate those kinds of observations into the way that we do science.
Now, another movement that we've seen in recent years, as well as drawing in fishermen, is also the fact that most fishery science to date, when we say fishery science, we've been referring to biological science, some oceanography, but really the natural sciences. But you've also got a whole social sciences branch at the Fishery Science Center. So where does social science fit into this framework?
In many different ways. I'm very pleased that we have such a strong social sciences group at the Science Center here. They play a significant role in the regulatory process in terms of evaluating the impact of regulations on fishermen and on communities. But they also are engaged in a lot of other different kinds of research. Thinking about the cooperative research, a large part of the way that we do our cooperative research relates to the way that we communicate with the fishing industry. If we listen to our social scientists, and I'm listening more and more to them, we can learn better how to communicate, how to have conversations with the fishing industry and other stakeholders, which break down some of these cultural barriers and let us understand each other better. And that, I think, is going to lead to improved overall communications, but better science as well.
So it's not just that we have social science informing us about, say, the economic impacts of regulation or changes in the fishing community, but the social science is actually circling back and telling you how to do better natural science for the fishery community.
Yes, absolutely. And as we move towards what we call the ecosystem approach to fisheries management, the ecosystem includes humans. So we have to recognize what the role of humans are in the ecosystem, not just as something outside the ecosystem which impacts it in some way or another. And again, we need our social scientists to help us do that.
Dr. Bill Karp is the director of the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, a branch of the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Now, up next, we'll continue our conversation about the role of social sciences in fisheries with Dr. Matt McPherson. He's the social sciences branch chief at the Northeast Fisheries Science Center here in Woods Hole. More after a short break.
I can remember once when I was about 5, we used to go out on the breakwater and fish for chogsies.
Carrie Scheller of West Tisbury.
And I needed some new hooks. And I didn't have any money, so I went into my grandmother's closet. I knew where her purse was, and I took out a bill. So I went down to Fisher's store, which was right down there by the dock. That's Arnie Fisher's father. And I got 5 cents worth of fish hooks. And he began peeling bills out, and I'd taken a $20 bill. I don't know whether she found out about it or not. Only time I ever took anything scared the you-know-what out of me.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
I'm Jay Allison, here to tell you we still have room for another local storyteller for WCAI's Big Moth Night this summer on the Vineyard. Pick up the phone or go to the web to pitch us your story for a chance to join Adam Gopnik, Jenny Allen, Buddy Vanderhoop, and more for a night of great storytelling at the Tabernacle in Oak Bluffs on August 3rd. Go to themoth.org to find out more and record your pitch. That's themoth.org. Hope to see you there. Thanks.
Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking this hour about the role of science in fishery management. Federal law says fishing regulations should be based on the best available science. That's traditionally been interpreted as stock assessments, but there's increasing recognition that social sciences, economics, oral histories, demographics could all make significant contributions to fishery management. Here to talk more about that is Dr. Matt McPherson. He's the chief of the social sciences branch of the Northeast Fisheries Science Center. Matt, welcome.
Thanks, Heather. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Now, you're going to have to forgive me a bad stereotype here, but when I see the word anthropologist, I tend to think of someone studying perhaps native populations in Papua New Guinea. Why, as an anthropologist, would you choose to study New England's fisheries?
Well, in the same way as other resource users throughout the world, in the same way as the tribal communities in Papua New Guinea, New England fishermen have a traditional long-standing resource use practice. So actually, I think studying New England fishermen is actually something that's very appropriate for anthropologists.
Now, how long has social science been part of research at National Marine Fisheries Service and the Northeast Fisheries Science Center here in particular?
Well, I should point out, even though you started mentioning anthropology, the early involvement of social science scientists and the most prominent involvement of social scientists at the Science Center has been of economists. So our social sciences branch actually consists of 10 economists and 5 social scientists. Most of the sociocultural experts, most of us are trained in anthropology, but we have someone who has a public policy background. The involvement of social sciences began with the hiring of the first economists back in the late 1970s. And it actually was a small group in the Science Center up until probably about 15 years ago when, after the reauthorization of the Magnuson-Stevens Act in 1996, there was a little bit more emphasis placed in the agency on the social sciences, and more resources were devoted to expanding the number of social scientists within the agency and supporting social science research.
So how, back in those early days, how did social sciences, I guess primarily economics, contribute to fishery management, or was it kind of a side endeavor?
My understanding is that in the early days, you know, there were a small number of economists who spent a lot of time trying to figure out ways to gather data. So actually, as the, you know, new procedures were being, you know, put into place to gather, you know, fisheries data, things like, you know, through, you know, permits and dealer reporting and vessel reporting, that the economists were involved in trying to make sure that there was going to be data, you know, that would be collected that would, you know, facilitate economic research. And they were also, you know, more involved in studying some, you know, some sort of longer term economic trends. I think as time went on, our economists became much more heavily involved in the management process and in providing management support. And that's something that, you know, as a branch, we spend a great deal of time doing is providing management support to both the New England Fisheries Management Council as well as the Mid-Atlantic Management Council.
Well, of course, the Magnuson-Stevens Act that overrides all of fishery management, of course, requires that regulations be based on best available science, but also requires that the socioeconomic impacts of regulations be taken into account. And so presumably there's a strong role there for social science to actually be gauging what those socioeconomic impacts are.
Right. So we conduct studies that meet the regulatory requirements that were established in the National Environmental Protection Act, as well as within Magnuson, for conducting social and economic impact assessments. And there are also other a series of other regulations and executive orders that require examining primarily economic impacts on small entities, and then also doing cost benefit analyses of regulations and things like that. So we're involved in all of the compliance with all those different regulations and legal requirements.
We just heard Dr. Bill Karp, the director of the Northeast Fisheries Science Center, say that he's listening more and more to your group, to his social scientists, which implies to me that perhaps in the past there was not as much listening to the social sciences and that your role is increasing. Is that what's going on at this point? Is social sciences becoming a more prominent part of fishery management?
Well, I think we hope that that's happening. You know, as I mentioned, there's been an increased opportunity, I think, over the last probably 10 years because we have more staff and there are more resources, you know, devoted to social science research than there were at the past. At the same time, it really is important to point out that the, you know, the level of resources that are invested in social science research in comparison to, you know, the level of resources that are invested in stock assessments and biological research really are just minuscule. I mean, we have, you know, a staff of 15 full-time social scientists, two market news reporters, you know, in a center of 270 people. So, you know, so we're really excited about, you know, about the fact that we just have this really strong, talented, diverse staff. And I think that we are increasing our ability to make an impact on the management process. But I think there's still a lot more that we could do.
Well, so let's talk about some examples of the research that you have been doing recently. Of course, everyone's aware of the economic crisis in the groundfish fishery with restrictions on cod catches. And a couple of years ago, there was a transition to this new management style known as catch shares, which has been very controversial. And the economic assessments of how the groundfish fishery is doing have been kind of high profile and fairly controversial over the past couple of years.
Right. Well, that's, I think, one of the significant areas of research that we've moved into that is increasing our, you know, or has the potential impact or increase our impact on the management process. And that's the area of fisheries performance measures, which essentially are indicators of how the fisheries are performing from a social and economic standpoint and things like, you know, revenue generation and the distribution of revenue in the fishing industry, profitability, fisheries diversity and employment. And, you know, we're planning on this actually the thinking behind this is that it could be sort of a parallel set of information to stock assessments. So we provide fisheries performance information and trends information as well, you know, at the same time as information on biological trends is being provided. And we're hoping to be able to report out on all of the fisheries we work with in terms of their performance, but the early efforts and the most high-profile efforts have been in our annual groundfish performance reports, which we've published over the last 2 years, and we're getting ready in August of this year to publish the 2012 version of that report.
Well, when you say performance review, it implies that you're kind of making a judgment of something's performing well or not performing well, and you've got indicators in there, things like how much revenue is coming in, how many vessels are active in the fleet. Are you making a judgment about whether or not these indicators are indicating good performance, or are you just putting these numbers out there to be evaluated and judged by, I guess, the rest of the community?
We're putting the numbers out. We're not trying to make any value judgments about those numbers, although clearly in comparison to past trends, we could do some evaluation as if it's, you know, whether trends are looking, you know, more favorable or unfavorable in comparison to the past. But no, we really are trying to get that information out there. We're not trying to make those value judgments. We'd leave the value judgments up, you know, to the decision makers as to whether they're seeing trends that they find to be positive or find to be negative.
So how have your groundfish indicators been received by the community?
I think, you know, there has been I think overall they've been very positively, you know, received because we've provided a lot of information. But it's really important to point out that the fishing community is very heterogeneous. So a trend that may look positive to one group within the fishing community may look, you know, negative, you know, to other groups. So you know, maybe for one sector of the industry, increasing consolidation or decreased fleet diversity isn't necessarily something to be alarmed about, whereas for other groups, it's something that, you know, that they're very, very concerned about. So it's been received in a number of different ways.
So social science can give us these numbers about the economic impacts or the economic changes going on. Can social sciences help managers and help the community navigate some of those value judgments about what is the right or the better thing to do with our fisheries? Let's take, you know, this issue of consolidation, fewer boats, perhaps larger boats doing better under catch shares. Can social sciences help provide some guidance in terms of making the value judgments about how to respond to those kinds of changes in the fleet?
I think that we can conduct research that would help to provide information of what kinds of values different groups have. I think one of the issues that has faced, you know, social scientists in the management process has been the fact that we don't really have very clear, explicit social and economic objectives for the fisheries. So even though Magnuson mentions things like, you know, fisheries should support, you know, food production and recreational activities, should, you know, support, you know, fishing dependent communities. Those are kind of mentioned, but they've never really been explicitly defined. But I think, you know, as social scientists, clearly we can do research that would help us understand really what are the preferences and what are the values of different, you know, segments of the fishing community as well as the public at large with regards to how those fisheries should be managed.
Well, one of the other projects that you guys have going on right now this summer in New England is your crew survey. We're actually surveying, obviously, the crew of fishing boats to find out some basic socioeconomic demographic sorts of information. And it was really interesting to me reading about this study to see that scientists from your group were saying, essentially, we know next to nothing about the crew that are on these fishing boats. I mean, we've had a fishing industry in New England for 500 years, and yet we know very little about the people who are actually doing it.
Right. We know very, very little about especially crew. That's a sort of a key information gap, and it's really a critical topic. You know, it's really about the amount and quality of employment within the fishery. And available labor is and availability of quality labor is something, you know, that vessel owners have often talked about as something that influences, that may even influence their decision as to whether or not they should, you know, stay in the fishing industry. You know, I think, you know, some of the regulatory, some of the impacts of regulatory, different regulatory actions on crew is something, you know, that's been overlooked. So we're hoping that this survey is going to provide us, you know, with a new set of sort of best scientific information available that we can use to better take into account, you know, impacts of changes in the fisheries on crew.
Now, you also recently released a report about the economics of the recreational for hire industry. And that, to me, is really intriguing. The recreational side of fishing seems like it could be particularly challenging to get a handle on. I mean, in part because you've got, you know, you don't have just your licensed commercial fishermen going out. It's this much broader segment of the population. So what were some of the things that we learned from that report about the recreational for hire industry?
Well, I mean, I'm not particularly expert on this area. Our economist, Scott Steinbeck, is our expert on recreational fisheries. But I think, you know, overall we've learned that recreational, you know, fishing, you know, has a major economic contribution, you know, both, you know, at the regional level, you know, as well as at the national level. You know, recreational fishing is something where we've been conducting a number of different studies and surveys, as you mentioned. And there are actually two, you know, major recent studies. People can go to our website and find those studies if they'd like to learn more about the results.
Well, we'll have a link to some of those from our website as well. I want to talk about how this idea that Dr. Bill Karp mentioned, that how social science could actually help improve the functioning of the management and regulatory framework and actually maybe even improve the science simply by easing communication between different groups within the industry?
Yeah, I think that, you know, for us, we try to work, you know, very closely with industry, and we depend on the industry, you know, on as key informants and as local experts, you know, for information that we use in social impact analyses, for ground truthing of our data, for verification of models. So as social scientists, we're very dependent on working, you know, with industry. And we think, you know, we have a good relationship, you know, with industry. And outreach and, you know, communication is very, very important to us for that reason. I would like, you know, to emphasize that the kinds of outreach activities that we do, you know, are for research objectives, and not in the past. Sometimes it's been thought that social scientists are sort of expert facilitators or expert environmental educators, and we'd be good to go out and do outreach to, you know, convince fishermen to follow management rules and things like that. And that's not at all the purpose of our outreach. But I think that, you know, because in the methodology that we used, we're used to integrating, you know, socioeconomic information from fishermen into the management process. I think that we are well positioned to also, you know, help to integrate fishermen's local ecological knowledge into the management process as well.
Now, a lot of the research that you do is based on interviews with fishermen, and you have the wonderful project of oral histories of fishermen. Why oral histories in particular? And the fact that they are histories, does this imply that somehow these fishermen and their fishery is becoming a part of the past? Or is this just a tool to record what's going on?
I think that, I mean, from the perspective of an anthropologist, we like to record that rich information, you know, that people have, you know, about that the way that they that the way that they fish and you know, the whole all the nuances about the fishing, you know, fisheries livelihoods. So I mean, oral histories is really a good way to you know, to capture those kinds of nuances. I think there is, you know, practices are constantly changing, and I think it is an acknowledgement that, you know, that there are major changes that are taking place, and it is a way of recording, you know, fishing heritage. And I think it also – oral histories are also a way of, you know, acknowledging the local, you know, the expertise and knowledge that fishermen have, you know, and getting that down on tape and being able to record some of that ecological knowledge as well that can be used to, you know, better understand the biological dimensions of the fishery as well as the social and economic dimensions of the fishery.
We have just a couple minutes here. Could you give us an example of a project that you guys have coming up that you're particularly excited about, a future direction for your group?
I think we are getting ready to do research on fish markets and fish supply chains. We really have another area where we really don't have that much information is what happens to the fish after it hits the dock. And I think that we're really concerned with working to develop a better understanding of what happens to local fish in particular after it hits the dock, what kinds of markets there are for local fish, and how, you know, what the factors are that, you know, could affect, you know, the pricing of fish. And I think as, you know, stocks for some of these fish are reduced, you know, the attention to markets is more important. You know, how can we maximize the prices that fishermen are, you know, getting for fish? How can we maximize the quality? And what kinds of local markets are available for fish that maybe would be considered, you know, I think to be, for lack of a better term, underutilized, you know, fish like redfish or dogfish that, you know, in the past there were actually active markets for those fish. But some of those markets have, you know, have been lost. So the marketing side and the integration of local fish into the regional economy is something that we're really excited about working on.
Well, Matt McPherson, thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Matt McPherson is chief of the Social Sciences branch of the Northeast Fishery Science Center. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, we'll turn our attention to the different roles of government and academic researchers in advancing fishery science. Stay with us.
Another Science Minute.
All right, so one example is this tank here full of squid. This is called sometimes the Woods Hole squid.
Senior scientist Roger Hanlon of the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole.
As a biomedical model organism, there have been 3 Nobel Prizes won for work on the squid nervous system. The so-called lowly squid is this fantastic world-class model of a single nerve fiber and how it works. And Alzheimer's disease and Lou Gehrig disease and any neurological disorder you can think of has to do with the basic mechanism of how a nerve fiber works. And much of the basic information has come from the squid nerve fiber, not the human nerve fiber, because this one is enormous. It's 4 to 5 centimeters long. It's almost 1 millimeter wide. That's 100 times larger than any nerve fiber in your body or a blue whale's body. It's the biggest nerve on Earth. Very nervy squid.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Alfredo Corchado, who spent years covering the violence of drug cartels in Mexico. Once at a restaurant in Laredo, Texas, 2 young men came in with a warning.
One of them takes his hand out and points at me and does like he was using a gun. Bam, bam, bam.
Corchado's new memoir is called Midnight in Mexico. Join us.
That's at 10 o'clock tonight on the Cape and Islands NPR station.
You're listening to Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking this hour about the role of science in fishery management and the many possible definitions of the phrase, quote, best of scientific information available. That's what federal law says should guide conservation and management decisions, but pinning down what that means can be difficult. For example, should who does the science be a factor? To weigh in on that question, we have on the phone Dr. Steve Kadron. He's an associate professor of fisheries oceanography at UMass Dartmouth School for Marine Science and Technology. Before that, he was a fishery researcher with the National Marine Fisheries Service. Steve Kadron, welcome to Living Lab.
Hi, Heather. Happy to join you.
Now, some fishermen, and we should make it clear that certainly not all fishermen feel this way, but there's a vocal subset of fishermen who can get very personal, very emotional about their comments about, in particular, government fishery scientists. You're in academia now, but you've been there. You've been one of those fishery scientists. What does it feel like to be on the receiving end of some of those comments?
Yeah, it's very difficult not to take it personally because I think most people working in fishery science are highly dedicated. They put a lot of their own energy and investment into what they're doing. And to hear criticism, I think one reaction is to take it personally. Of course, from the other end, as fishermen's livelihoods are being affected by decisions, they're also taking the decisions personally. And so really, I think the more appropriate focus is on the quality of the science and the basis for the decision making, so that we can really try to focus on improving that science and improving the effectiveness of the decision.
Are your relationships with fishermen better now that you're out of government and into the academic realm?
I'd say that my relationship with fishermen started improving while I was still a federal scientist, when I started working with them directly through cooperative research, spending time at sea with fishermen, discussing the biology of fish rather than the management decisions that are being made, understanding fishermen's perspective on different marine ecosystem processes. That's when our relationship really started to improve. But then again, going to academia, where I'm no longer directly associated with the agency that's making the management decisions, I think that does help as well to separate those two things, the science from the management. As Bill Karp told you on your show earlier today, there are separate processes even in the federal government for the science and the management, but it's very difficult for fishermen to separate those when they're getting management decisions from the same agency that's doing the science. So I think they are naturally put together.
So cooperative research can obviously help build better relationships even when in the government setting. Does cooperative research work any differently when you're in the academic setting?
Well, I suppose it does, in that we have a different research agenda. Many times cooperative research done through the federal government is toward a short-term decision, where in academia we're not necessarily working along the decision timelines that federal agency scientists are. We may be working toward longer-term, bigger questions of ecosystem sciences. So there could be a different nature to what we're doing with fishermen.
And what is the different role for academic fishery scientists? As you said, you're not part of the management framework directly. So how do you see your role as an academic fishery scientist in the broader context of fisheries?
Yeah, I guess the way I see it is that the distinct role of academics is in the research and development of advancing fishery science. Because fisheries science is so applied towards decision-making, often it is tailored to the next decision. And to do that, we really need to develop a convention for science, whether that's in the field of sampling fisheries or sampling the populations, putting those together into a stock assessment, as Bill Karp described to you earlier, and the peer review process. That's all a fairly conventional process that produces the information needed for decision making. But the role of academics is really to step outside of that timeline of decision making to try to improve both the technology and the approach of fishery science. And so it's really, as I see it, the research and development arm of fishery science, where we can be applying new technologies, whether that's acoustic surveys, video surveys, using information from advanced technology on fishing vessels, vessel monitoring system, temperature gauges, electronic tagging, so that we can even advance the statistics and modeling of the data, so that, again, in a longer term, we can advance the fishery science so that little by little that operational science is modified and improve so that it's applying best practices and new technology.
These new technologies, as you're testing them, we sometimes hear calls from fishermen saying, these scientists over here have a new technology that they think is working really well. Why isn't the government using it? How, in your view, should the transfer of this of new technologies or new methodologies proceed from, as you're calling it, the research and development wing of things, from the academic realm into the government realm?
Well, there are different stages. The first stage is proof of concept, that a new idea or a new technology can be taken into the field and it can meet its objectives. But then we really need to go through the scientific process. And the scientific process is still hypothesis-driven, where we form new hypotheses, we design experiments to test those hypotheses in the field. And so through this hypothesis testing and field testing, we can take a proof of concept and make it into operational science. Now, that may even take time, even after we've validated the method, verified that the results coming out of it are dependable for fishery management. You may need a time series. If we have a new survey technique, it may take time to develop a time series of that new survey so that it can be used in stock assessment and considered for fishery management.
So how has stock assessment science changed over the years? Are there examples of the adoption of new techniques and methods that perhaps were developed in academia and then eventually adopted by the National Marine Fisheries Service for stock assessments?
Yes. In fact, our school has, I think, one of the best examples in our video scallop survey. Dr. Kevin Stokesbury and Brian Rothschild had developed a video quadrat survey, which really applied some fairly ecological survey techniques to fisheries. It was a fishery independent. It worked with fishermen using their vessels to have a statistically designed survey. Over the years, that survey method was tested, validated, compared to other surveys, and slowly incorporated into the scallop stock assessment. And now it's a component of that stock assessment, and it's one of the reasons that that's one of our better stock assessments.
We'll actually be talking with Dr. Kevin Stokesbury next Monday about the scallop survey and how that transition happened. So we'll get more on that. I wonder if you could give us an example of a current problem or a gap in fishery science that you see and that you think needs to be worked on.
Yeah, we recently held a workshop on incorporating environmental change into stock assessment, and I'm hopeful that that is a direction that can help solve some of our problems. I think most of your listeners are well aware of changes in our environment as we see them day to day. But in our marine ecosystem, we've also had profound changes, both warming and circulation changes. Those physical changes are affecting plankton productivity, and that all trickles down into fish productivity. Fish are distributed differently geographically than they had been in the past. And so all these changes can have profound effects on the productivity of fish and their stock assessments, how we assess them and how we manage them. So in the past, a conventional stock assessment has made some simplifying assumptions in which we assume the environment is relatively constant. And in the past decades, that simplifying assumption was sufficient to have stock assessments that performed relatively well. However, now with environmental change, it appears as though those are affecting our stock assessments such that those simplifying assumptions are no longer sufficient. They're no longer an accurate enough representation of what's going on in the marine ecosystem. So we need to start paying attention to some of the processes that we had not been. Differences in productivity, differences in the recruitment of young fish, perhaps natural mortality of fish. As we've reduced a lot of the fishing effort, we've also rebuilt a lot of populations. So there's a lot more predators out there now, both mammal and fish predators. And we need to incorporate that in our science to try to improve the stock assessment.
So do we have the information that we need to incorporate environmental change into assessments?
Yes and no. For some of those processes, we're in a very data-rich environment. We're very fortunate that the Northeast Fishery Science Center and others have been investing in things like ecosystem surveys, stomach analysis of fish. And so we do have a lot of the information we need. But there are some processes, like probably the plankton, which we have not been monitoring as with as high a resolution as we need to model them. As we start understanding what are the important factors of the ecosystem, we will have to reprogram some of our sampling into others. The benthos is probably, that's the bottom. The animals that live right on the bottom and in the bottom are probably less studied and monitored than the rest of the ecosystem. And as those become important to ecosystem dynamics, we'll need to reinvest in those. So You know, none of us are really expecting large increases in the research budgets that are going into New England fisheries. So as we recognize that different factors are now more important to understanding fish productivity, we may need to reallocate some of our investments.
What would be involved? You're talking about these computer models that are essentially being used to simulate fish populations. What would be involved in modifying those models so that they better reflected the environmental changes that we're seeing?
Well, right now what we do is we simplify the marine ecosystem with mathematical models. Now, because we can't represent all of the complexity of the marine ecosystem, we have to make some really strategic decisions about how our model is going to be structured. And in the past, really over the last few decades, we've developed models that have focused on the fishery itself, focused on the target species, and those had performed well. But now we need to see that we need to focus on more species that live alongside that target species, maybe species that are caught alongside that target species. We also need to look at factors other than the fishery, and so we need to expand those models. And you mentioned simulation. And simulation has really taken on a very large role in stock assessment and in evaluating the performance of stock assessment. So one advantage of simulation is that we can really free up some of those simplifications. We can have a simulation model that has, you know, much more complexity representing the marine ecosystem. And then in simulation, we can make different simplifying assumptions and test the performance of those different strategic simplifications. And so what we call this is management strategy evaluation. So we come up with different management procedures, including how much we invest in sampling target species or non-target species, and we see how that performs, at least in simulation. And then hopefully we can apply that in the real world and see if it performs well in the real world as well.
We have just a couple seconds, but I want to ask, given budget constraints, is the improvement of these models something that could happen in academia and be transferred to the National Marine Fisheries Service eventually?
Yes. Coincidentally, we have a world conference in Boston next week that's bringing together some of the best stock assessment scientists throughout the globe, and we'll be largely using simulation exercises to test the performance of different stock assessment methods.
Dr. Steve Cadron is Associate Professor of Fisheries Oceanography at UMass Dartmouth School for Marine Science and Technology. Steve Cadron, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And thanks all for listening. This is Living Lab on the Point. You can find Living Lab Radio every day on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone,
okay,
with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support is provided by Michael and Roxanne Zack. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.